Chapter 6. Millennia Unaccounted For. When Tom Demaray dug deep enough, he turned up evidence of humans in North America 130,000 years ago that was sufficiently robust to make it through nature's rigorous peer review process and into print in April 2017. By then, it was no longer news that the New World had been peopled long before Clovis. In Chapter 4, we saw that Monteverde, Meadowcroft, and Bluefish Caves had already pushed back the date of the first Americans from around 13,000 years ago to at least 24,000 years ago. These, however, are only three sites among a growing number that suggest a vast, complex, textured antiquity for the human presence in the Americas across ages when hitherto we've been asked to picture an uninhabited wilderness awaiting the arrival of man. No matter how long it exists, an uninhabited wilderness will not produce a civilization, and it would make no sense to look for one there. But with new evidence continuing to pour forth, it's increasingly obvious that humans were in the Americas not just for thousands of years before Clovis, but for tens of thousands of years, all the way back to the Cerruti Mastodon site or earlier, and thus had vast expanses of time at their disposal to develop in any direction they chose. Wanting to get a better feeling for the time depth of this mystery leads me through various contacts and connections to a walk in the South Carolina woods. It's early November, a sunny yet cold morning. There's a mulch of fallen leaves underfoot, but the trees around us are still in foliage, mostly green with muted hints of autumnal reds and yellows beginning to mottle the canopy. I'm with Albert, Al Goodyear, professor of archaeology at the University of South Carolina, around 70 years of age, cheerful and in rubicund good health. He's wearing a South Carolina Gamecocks baseball cap, a navy check shirt, a tweed jacket, and tough outdoor pants tucked into his hiking boots to keep ticks carrying Lyme disease at bay. Our ramble takes us close to the Savannah River, which here forms the border between the states of South Carolina and Georgia. Al is a world expert on the Clovis culture, and back in 1998, having excavated an extensive Clovis lair in these woods, he dug deeper. In the end, what he found was evidence that humans had been here 50,000 years ago. Not as old as the Cerruti Mastodon by any means, but still a good 37,000 years before Clovis. Unsurprisingly, Clovis firsters were adamantly opposed and launched a campaign to discredit the find. The site is now called Topper, after David Topper, a local forester. In 1981, he spotted stone tools on the ground here. He notified Al, who a couple of years later launched a comprehensive archaeological survey of the Savannah River watershed. As part of this larger project, excavations began at Topper in 1986, and it was immediately obvious that Native Americans had been coming here for many thousands of years. Obvious, too, was the reason why. A huge outcrop of easily accessible chert, the raw material of a form of flint ideal for making stone tools. Al suddenly stoops and picks up a small, almost translucent piece of reddish flint from the ground at our feet. It is, recognizably, a fragment of an arrowhead with a notch near the base. Al confirms my guess that it's not Clovis. It's a nice piece, he says. It's been heat-treated. It's probably about 8,000 years old. He draws my attention to an area off the path, relatively free of fallen leaves, where there's quite a scatter of stones, mostly small, broken pieces like this one. Al refers to them as debitage, the technical term for lithic debris and discards found at sites where stone tools and weapons were made. Every flake on the ground was struck off by a human, he says, and you can roughly tell the age. With strong coloration, they're more recent, but if they're white and creamy, they're weathered and older. Our next stop is the Chert Quarry, the reason so much was going on around Topper for so long. For them, this was like aluminium bauxite or iron ore for our culture, Al explains. They didn't have jackhammers, they didn't have crowbars, they just had to work what they could get off the surface, maybe set a fire or something to push it out, So we call this topper chert, the chert source for the topper site. I find it amazing, I say, that there are still broken points 8,000 years old just lying around on the surface, whereas you have to excavate to reach other materials from that horizon. The Earth is a dynamic place, Hal explains, with multiple different processes of deposition and erosion underway at all times. You can make guesses based on style and weathering, but fragments of worked stone that have been in the open for an unknown period can't be dated by their archaeological context, because there is none. Carbon dating organic materials in the sediment in which they were found won't work either, because they were never entombed and preserved in sediment. And in fact, no other objective and widely accepted method of dating can tell us how old they are. For these reasons, archaeologists have to discount artifacts found on the surface when coming to any conclusions about the age of a site, even though the artifacts themselves may obviously be ancient. Their presence, however, does serve as a clue that much more might be awaiting discovery underground, which was precisely why Arl followed up David Topper's 1981 suggestion to take a look. There's a first time for everything. After their first season of excavation at Topper in 1986, Arl and his team methodically worked their way down during the next dozen years through the levels of what was turning out to be a very extensive, detailed, and time-consuming excavation. There were a number of archaeological horizons here, stacked one above the other in nice, easily datable layers of sediment, containing the leavings of different cultures at different and increasingly more ancient periods of the past. We found pottery down to about 2,000 years ago, Arl says. Below that, there was no pottery, but there were plentiful artifacts from the period we call the Archaic. So we kept on going down, and we got into the early Archaic, around 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. They made these beautiful little notched points. And then below that, in 1998, bingo, we found Clovis. Topper is the only Clovis site to be excavated on the coastal plains of Georgia and the Carolinas. As though by way of compensation, however, the Clovis level at Topper turned out to be so massive that the excavations there would not be complete until 2013. As he tells me about the treasure trove of more than 40,000 Clovis artifacts that he and his team uncovered, Arl radiates excitement. And rightly so. It was a tremendous achievement that continues to enjoy renown amongst archaeologists. The same, however, cannot be said for what happened next. So we got down to the bottom of the Clovis level, Arl continues, and then we all voted to go deeper. For the next half meter or so, there was just sand and small gravels, devoid of any evidence of human presence, and then suddenly the excavators found themselves among artifacts again. I ask if there was a particular aha moment. Arl laughs. My aha was more of an uh-oh. Everybody else was going aha, but they weren't going to have to stand up at national conferences and defend what we'd found. Which was evidence, I asked, of the presence of humans in America tens of thousands of years before Clovis? Exactly, Arl replies. After we'd done a thorough lab analysis, we were certain we were dealing with artifacts. I ask him when he began to feel the inevitable wrath of the Clovis First lobby. Immediately, he replies. It began with, we don't believe in pre-Clovis. There's no such thing as a pre-Clovis culture. Then I think when it was realized we'd made a strong case that many of our flake tool artifacts had been produced by the bend-break technique, and that the media were already on to the potential significance of what we'd found, the critics moved the goalposts and said things like, okay, we understand bend-breaks, but we don't know of an assemblage anywhere that has so many bend-breaks. But the key issue remained the antiquity of the site. The New York Times was here, Arl says. CNN, they were all holding their stories until the dates came back. And I was thinking, maybe they'll come back at 20,000 years ago, maybe even 25,000 years ago, and I'll be out of here clean. This is going to be easy. But the date that came back was 50,000, ancient beyond all imagining, and right at the limits of radiocarbon. Since then, we have OSL dated the deposit, and those dates also came back in the range of 50,000. So we've got it dated two ways. But still the skeptics keep saying that what we've found can't be a human site, and that our artifacts must be works of nature because they're so different from the artifacts found at other sites, to which my response is, well, you've never dug a 50,000-year-old site in America, right? There's a first time for everything. They understood the properties of stone. After our pleasant hike, we've reached the main excavation area, a large rectangular pit about 12 feet deep, 40 feet wide, and around 60 feet long, where the majority of the archaeology trenches have been left open in their original condition and the entire area covered over with a roofed shelter. It's tastefully done, allowing in plenty of light but keeping out rain, and it's an education to see the stratigraphy through which Goodyear and his team dug to reach the controversial pre-Clovis levels. Although Topper is located on land owned by a specialty chemicals company and not open for public access, Al does occasionally bring interested groups here to explain the site to them. And to this end, signs have been set up, identifying the different levels. My eyes are drawn immediately to one that says, Clovis level, 13,000 years. Farther down, another reads, Pleistocene alluvial sands, 16,000 to 20,000 years. We step down again to the excavation floor, and I see the thick band of clay where the pre-Clovis artifacts were found, labeled Pleistocene Terrace, 20,000 to 50,000 years. Off to the side, laid out as a display, is a row of three or four chunky, fist-size rocks. I'll pick one up. The more abundant pre-Clovis artifacts are fashioned from chert cobbles like this, he tells me, but they're no good to anybody as they are. They have to be cracked open first. You have to get rid of all this, he indicates the rough, heavily patinated surface of the cobble, to get at the stuff inside that can be turned into tools. In experiments, we've thrown cobbles like that, slammed cobbles like that against each other, and nothing breaks. So what does break them, I ask? When we put an 8-pound sledgehammer on them, that did the trick. But presumably, the pre-Clovis people didn't have 8-pound sledgehammers. Al shrugs. Maybe they did it the way the Australian Aborigines used to deal with big slabs of quartzite. They didn't have sledgehammers either. They would light a small fire underneath the face of the quartzite, and they would wait for it to get hot enough till they heard a tink, and then they would pull a slab off. So I think you could use fire to prepare the cobble, and then maybe break it apart. The point is, once you break open a piece of flint like that, then you can do anything you want with it. All of the interior surfaces are susceptible to flaking, but the cobble in its raw form is not. So when our critics say that cobbles like these maybe got broken by rolling down the slope of the escarpment, our answer is no. What you need is heat, or something like an 8-pound sledgehammer, and even then we had to hit them several times before they broke. In other words, only humans could have done this? Right, Al confirms. Human beings who understood the properties of the stone and how to work it. If nature can't break it, it can't make it. None of the pre-Clovis tools have been left at the excavation, of course, but before we set out for the site this morning, Al showed me examples kept at the South Carolina Institute of Archaeology and Anthropology exhibit at its nearby regional campus in Allendale. What quickly becomes clear, which Al willingly concedes, was that they were, without exception, extremely simple and generally quite small, with unifacial flake tools such as burins and small blades predominating. The vast majority of the burins, more than 1,000 of them, were created by the distinctive flint-napping technique known as bend-break, whereby two edges are broken off at a 90-degree angle to form a sharp, sturdy tip that may have been used in the engraving of bone, antler, or wood. Flint cores left over after large flakes had been struck off were also found in close proximity to a large anvil stone. It appears there were several separate rock-chipping stations like this, resembling workstations. A very long time. The extensive evidence from the pre-Clovis levels at Topper clearly does not document the handiwork of any kind of lost advanced civilization. What it speaks to me of instead, like the Ceruti mastodon site, is a far more complex and nuanced past for the peopling of the Americas than has hitherto been properly contemplated. I don't propose here to give a blow-by-blow account of the 50 or so sites in the Americas, with more found every year, presently claimed to be of pre-Clovis antiquity. Not all are of the same quality. Some may not be archaeological sites at all, their supposed artifacts perhaps being geofacts. Others are very strong. A measure of discernment is therefore needed along this continuum, and what I observe is that archaeologists who are open to the notion of greater antiquity, these days the majority, apart from a few diehards, consider the most important pre-Clovis sites in North America, in addition to Ceruti and Topper, to include Huetlaco, Mexico, Old Crow and Bluefish Caves, Canada, Calico Mountain, California, Pendejo Cave, New Mexico, Tula Springs, Nevada, Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, Pennsylvania, Cactus Hill, Virginia, Paisley 5 Mile Point Caves, Oregon, Schaefer and Hebbior Mammoth Site, Wisconsin, Buttermilk Creek, Texas, and Saltville, Virginia. In South America, Pedra Ferrada in Brazil, Monteverde in Chile, Taima Taima in Venezuela, and Tibito in Colombia are likewise singled out as convincing pre-Clovis sites of special interest. However, other than some anomalies, indeed some deep mysteries connected to a select few of these sites, which we'll come to in later chapters, most feature only rudimentary stoneworking technologies similar to those of pre-Clovis Topper, although with definite evidence of increasing refinement and improved techniques between early pre-Clovis and late pre-Clovis. Early or late, however, the importance of all these sites as I view them has nothing to do with the level of technology they manifest, whether judged to be low or increasingly refined or whatever. They really matter in that they offer compelling proof of the enduring presence of humans of some kind in the Americas from perhaps as far back as 130,000 years ago until today. That's a very long time. It might even be long enough, speaking entirely hypothetically, of course, for something that we would recognize as an advanced civilization to have emerged in the Americas alongside the hunter-gatherers, foragers, and scavengers whose simple tools dominate the pre-Clovis horizons so far excavated. But if such a civilization was indeed present somewhere on the American landmass, how has it escaped the notice of archaeologists up to now, while the hunter-gatherers have not? And isn't it grasping at straws in the first place, even to suggest that an advanced civilization could have coexisted with hunter-gatherers during the Ice Age? Preconceptions are blinkers. Let's call to mind how things are in our own globally connected 21st century. Rio de Janeiro, Bogota, and Lima are, by any standards, advanced technological cities. Yet on the same continent, in the depths of the Amazon rainforest, uncontacted tribes of hunter-gatherers remain at a Stone Age level of technology. Likewise in Africa, Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Windhoek are advanced technological cities. Yet you can walk from them to the Kalahari Desert, where San Bushmen, though well aware of the technological world, choose to continue a hunter-gatherer and still largely Stone Age way of life. There are no purely logical grounds, therefore, that can rule out the possible coexistence of an advanced civilization with hunter-gatherers during the Ice Age. Nor can this, at first sight, absurd possibility be ruled out on archaeological grounds. For more than half a century, as we've seen, American archaeology was so riddled with preformed opinions about how the past should look and about the orderly, linear way in which civilizations should evolve that it repeatedly missed, sidelined, and downright ignored evidence for any human presence at all prior to Clovis, until at any rate the mass of that evidence became so overwhelming that it took the existing paradigm by storm. We thus find ourselves in a place now where Clovis first can quite definitely be ruled out, despite the fading protests of a very few zealots still clinging on to that discredited fantasy. At the same time, no new ruling paradigm, let alone consensus, has yet taken its place. Several are vying for the crown, though all remain rooted in the preconception that what they must explain is limited to the presence of relatively simple and unsophisticated hunter-gatherers in the Americas much earlier than had previously been supposed. None have factored in the possibility, they would be puzzled at the very thought, that a lost civilization might be part of the missing picture as well. I'm reminded of Tom Demarais' point. If you go to a place, and if you absolutely rule out in advance that humans were there 130,000 years ago, then you're clearly not going to find evidence that they were. By the same reasoning, if we don't ever look for a lost civilization, because of a preconception that none could have existed, then we won't find one. Fortunately, as we'll see in part 3, geneticists have developed sophisticated techniques for studying ancient DNA that have overturned entrenched thinking and opened completely new and unexpected avenues of inquiry.